You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, last week's presidential election in Wisconsin was a close one, and that's becoming a new normal here in the state. We'll look into why most elections over the past 20 years have come down to the wire. Now, pharmaceutical company Pfizer announced this weekend that its COVID-19 vaccine is at least 90% effective in preventing the virus. This is based on an outside review of early data as part of its clinical trials. The announcement has been seen as a bright spot in the fight against COVID-19, which has killed more than 1.2 million people worldwide, and with big jumps in cases in Wisconsin and around the country. But the vaccine is still in its early days, and it could be a while before it's widely available. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the news? What questions do you have about vaccines, how they work, what it takes to get them from this stage to people? Will you get the COVID-19 vaccine once it's available? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Dr. William Hartman is an assistant professor of anesthesiology at UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also principal investigator for the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine clinical trial and has been developing other COVID-19 treatments. Dr. Hartman, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what, first of all, is your reaction to this announcement from Pfizer, which looks to me as a layperson like pretty good news?
I think it's very good news. As a person who has spent a lot of time researching these different vaccines and working with a vaccine trial at University of Wisconsin, I see this as a giant step forward. Lots of people have been skeptical of the timeline because the science has moved so quickly here. But I think people should be excited and should be thrilled that, you know, this was reviewed by an independent board who found the data convincingly 90% effective for this vaccine.
And let's look at that phrase, 90% effective. What exactly does that mean?
So what they do in these vaccine trials is a certain percentage of individuals will be treated with the vaccine and the other group will be treated with a sham or a placebo. At a certain point, they unblind the study. And in this case, there had to be a certain number of COVID infections in the entire study group. And then they just compare, did these infections happen in the vaccinated group or did they happen in the placebo group? And here they found that there was a 90% reduction in the number of cases in the vaccine group compared to the placebo group.
And when we say reduction in cases, does that mean people had no infection at all, or they might have had an infection but no symptoms? Do we know if this is preventing a person from, you know, catching the virus and having it spread within them, or is it preventing symptoms? Maybe a little bit of both.
I think it's a little bit of both. That part of the equation wasn't described. And so one of the criteria that they look at is if you do get infected, do you have one symptom or are you asymptomatic? And compare that as well to the placebo group. Therefore, it's highly possible that this 90% effectiveness either means it prevented the virus from infecting a person, or if they did get infected, the symptoms were way milder than they otherwise would have expected.
When we're doing testing on something like this, who are the kinds of people being tested? And does it include the people who might be most vulnerable to a disease like COVID-19, older people, overweight people with diabetes and heart conditions, it looks like? Did they end up getting included in the mix of subjects here?
The answer to that is yes. I can speak to the AstraZeneca protocol because that's the one that I'm most familiar with, since that's the vaccine that we're trialing at University of Wisconsin. And in that protocol, 25% of the population is to be 65 years old and older. The patients or the subjects that we screen, they can have be on any medicine as long as they're stable on that medicine. So there's all sorts of comorbid conditions that come into play here. And that was specifically requested by the companies and by Operation Warp Speed, so that we know that when this vaccine becomes available, it's safe in everybody and effective in everybody, no matter what comorbidities they have or what medicines they're taking.
Talking to Dr. William Hartman from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's working on one vaccine research project, the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine clinical trial. News that the company Pfizer has had a very promising development in their own testing process. You can join in, by the way, with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how vaccine research like this happens, and what goes into the development until it's actually available to top priority people and to everybody in the future? 800-642-1234. I want to share a tweet from the CEO of Pfizer. I'm quoting now: "Our COVID-19 vaccine, if approved, will be an important part of global, national, and state prevention plans, but not the only one. Everyone should continue to follow the guidance of the scientific community and local health authorities, and please remember to wear your masks." That's coming from Pfizer's CEO there. Dr. Hartman, I think the goal there is to say, yes, this is good news. Don't give up on those public health measures yet, though.
Right. So the vaccine is one more tool in the toolbox to fight this virus. And so the other measures of washing your hands, being outside more than inside, wearing a mask, socially distancing, those are all the other tools in the toolbox. And together, these things, when used in synchrony, are what's going to propel us forward. Using any one of them just by themselves is helpful, but using them in synchrony is really what we need to attack this virus.
Now, Pfizer says it can produce something like 15 to 20 million doses of the vaccine potentially by the end of the year, pending FDA approval. And there's a little more to go on that. That's obviously not everybody. What does it take to get from the stage we're in now to mass production in the millions and maybe hundreds of millions?
So the first thing, excuse me, is that you have to be able to produce the vaccine itself. And so these mRNA vaccines, they're grown in more of a laboratory type environment. They should be able to ramp up the production of these relatively quickly. The issue with the Pfizer vaccine is that it requires extremely cold temperatures for both transport and storage. And so while the vaccine itself might be available and ready to use, there will be many countries that won't be able to utilize this particular one because of that cold storage requirement.
You mentioned this is an mRNA vaccine, which, if I understand correctly, is kind of a new wrinkle in vaccines. What is that? What makes it different?
So the mRNA vaccines are kind of the newest generation of vaccines. And so the mRNA is the message of the genetic material, if you will. And the goal is to get that mRNA into cells, in this case, in the deltoid there. So it's the mRNA is packaged into this lipid droplet, essentially. These lipid droplets can get into the cells where the cells will, the cell's machinery that typically helps reproduce the genetic code within a cell, they're able to recognize this mRNA and build this spike protein, the spike protein that's on the virus itself. And that spike protein then gets exported from the cells into the bloodstream, where it would be recognized by the cells that make antibodies. And they make antibodies then to this spike protein. And so it's an easy design when you have the genetic code available, and the Chinese made the genetic code coronavirus available very, very early on in the process. So the design of the vaccine actually is quite simple. And it differs from other vaccines, such as the AstraZeneca one that I work with, which is a adenovirus vaccine. And so they take that the genetic material from the virus itself for that spike protein and put it into a different vector, a different virus vector that amplifies that spike protein. And it makes that spike protein and then amplifies it so that it can generate antibodies to be made as well. And so it's just there are different ways of getting to the same result. And they use different technologies, but again, the purpose is the same, to generate that spike protein so that the antibodies can be made to it.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was curious. One of the reports that I heard was that these results were based on 7 days after the after 7 days these were results, and I'm wondering if that is typical, and if not, if that causes any concern for your specialist.
The time scale of testing of the success of this vaccine. What do we know about that, Dr. Hartman?
There's a couple of ways to interpret it. My reading on the data that they interpreted was actually that it was based on 28 days. I hadn't seen the 7 day report, but I saw that it was based on 28 days, so a month after the last person had been injected with the vaccine. And so for the first run of efficacy data, this seems like a reasonable approach. Definitely when they follow these people, and these trials are all 2 years in length, so these participants are going to be followed for a long time. So we'll see over time how effective the vaccine remains compared to placebo. And it's also important to be able to follow the safety data. Now, the FDA has made it a requirement of these vaccines to have at least 2 months of safety data following the last injection of the vaccine. And so even if the effectiveness data is enough to convince the FDA at this point, they still have to have the 2 months of safety data available before it can be considered for the EUA, or the Emergency Use Authorization.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. William Hartman. He's an assistant professor of anesthesiology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's principal investigator for the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine clinical trial. He's with us to talk about the vaccine effort in general after the announcement from Pfizer that its COVID-19 vaccine is 90% effective at preventing the disease. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to that news? What questions do you have about the efforts to come up with COVID-19 vaccines? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the latest news in the race to develop a COVID-19 vaccine. This weekend, Pfizer announced its vaccine was seeing very positive results. Dr. William Hartman stays with us, assistant professor of anesthesiology at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also working on the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine clinical trial and has been working on other treatments related to COVID-19. You can join in 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about what goes into creating and testing and producing and distributing vaccines for a disease like COVID-19? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Hartman, the question from our caller raises also the question of how long a vaccine will be effective. Those are obviously questions we can't answer yet. But as you see it, is it likely that we're going to have a vaccine that we get once and we're done, or maybe two doses and we're done, or something we have to re-up on every year, 5 years? What determines that?
So these are questions that will be answered over this two-year period that we follow the participants and follow their antibody levels to figure out what their level of antibodies are and how does it decrease over time. My assumption at this point, based on the fact that the virus can mutate at a reasonable rate, that we would probably need to have some sort of booster every year, similar to the flu shot.
Interesting. How does it, from what we know about the mutation rate of the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19, again, it's pretty new in the scope of our understanding, but how does it compare to, say, an influenza virus when it comes to its speed of mutation over time?
Well, it's something that we'll have to continue to follow, but definitely, these viruses, they're designed to attack a host and get into their cells. And if you figure out ways to defeat it so it doesn't get in the cells, the virus is a very primitive organism, and it figures out very quickly what it needs to do to overcome that resistance. And so, that's how influenza virus changes every year. That's how many of these other viruses can change from year to year. And so it's something we have to keep an eye on. We have to continually monitor. But my guess is, the coronaviruses, they will always have these spike proteins. And so as long as we're able to identify that spike, we should be always able to generate an antibody response to it.
Let's bring on another caller now. Preston is with us in Stoughton. Preston, hello.
Hi there.
What do you want to ask about, Preston?
I was just curious about who would be first in line to receive the vaccines. I guess just the main concern behind my question is, since I have a wife who's a nurse, would it be healthcare professionals that receive the vaccine first?
Interesting. So Preston, thanks for the call. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
And that's an excellent question. And something that there's been several committees put together to help investigate. And healthcare workers are definitely first in line to receive the vaccine, followed very closely, most likely by the elderly population and other people considered most susceptible to the virus. So the young, healthy people are obviously going to be last in line, at least initially, as the rollout goes. But your wife being a nurse, clearly she's in a high-risk position. We have to take care of our healthcare workers. We will prioritize to make sure that they're the ones who are first inoculated with the vaccine.
Thanks a lot for that call. Great question. Dr. Hartman, I think a lot of us have been talking about hopefully a vaccine will be available. Should we have been speaking in the plural? Is it likely that we'll end up with multiple vaccines out there on the market and in the world?
I really believe that there will be multiple vaccines. And there's a certain thought that that's not such a bad thing either. If you're with these different vectors, different antibody responses can happen to the adenovirus that our vaccine here is working with. So maybe one injection with the AstraZeneca followed by a second injection with the Pfizer will produce a more robust response. We don't know the answer to that. Also, some are going to be more stable in one environment than in another environment. And one of the things that we're really trying to highlight in our study here at Madison is that we find a vaccine that's effective for all populations. So the black and brown population, Asian population, Caucasian population. And it's possible that one vaccine would be better for one group and not as quite as effective in the other group. And we have to make sure that we find vaccines and find answers for every group out there, because this is a virus that doesn't care how rich you are, how poor you are, or what color you are. It's going to attack everyone. And so we have to figure out a way to effectively eradicate it in all populations.
In just our last minute, we focused on vaccines, this conversation. What do you have your eye on briefly when it comes to therapeutics, things to treat people who have already caught the virus?
So I think one of the most exciting therapeutics right now are these monoclonal antibodies. The one that President Trump received, Regeneron, and the one that received an emergency use authorization by the FDA yesterday by Eli Lilly, both have a very excellent effectiveness profiles, especially when used early in disease. So before people need to go to a hospital, if we can treat them with these monoclonal antibodies, they've shown to effectively neutralize the virus. And so I think that these are very exciting developments, and they show tremendous promise in terms of being able to get after that virus early and keep people out of the hospital and then obviously out of ICUs and off of ventilators.
Dr. Hartman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. William Hartman is an assistant professor of anesthesiology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's principal investigator for the COVID-19 vaccine that's being developed by AstraZeneca in clinical trials. He joined us today to talk about Pfizer's announcement that its COVID-19 vaccine is 90% effective at preventing the novel coronavirus from causing disease symptoms. Coming up, we'll look at why close presidential elections in Wisconsin have become a new normal for most presidential years here in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers will deliver a statewide address. We'll bring you live coverage starting at 6. Evers will address the COVID-19 pandemic, which has killed now more than 2,300 people in Wisconsin and where the number of new cases has been rising since early September. It's live coverage tonight starting at 6 on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. Now, the presidential election last week came down to the wire in Wisconsin with President-elect Joe Biden coming out ahead by about 20,000 votes. That's kind of like the close finish here in the 2016 election, but President Trump came out over 20,000 votes ahead, and in a lot of elections before that. In fact, 4 out of the last 6 presidential elections in Wisconsin have been decided by less than 1%. 2 big exceptions came in the middle of that run with big wins by Barack Obama in the state. We're looking at what's changed in the state over that time, what stayed the same, and why close elections have become the rule rather than the exception. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think Wisconsin is such a close-run state come presidential election time? Have you noticed the political mood in your part of the state change over time? And are you somebody who usually votes Republican but voted for Barack Obama, or usually votes Democrat but voted for Donald Trump? Love to hear your story. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Craig Gilbert is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, good to have you back.
It's nice to be with you.
Well, here's my kind of setup for this conversation, Craig. You know, Donald Trump won, of course, in 2016 in Wisconsin, and I think he was looked at as the outlier, the only Republican to win the state in a long time. And so a lot of us were trying to explain why that was, so that makes sense. But then, you know, you look at the normal elections here in the state, so close, within 1% this year, 4 years ago, and before Barack Obama. But then Barack Obama wins by big margins. Maybe he's the outlier we should be studying. 6 points, 14-point wins. What do you think?
Well, I think he is the outlier. I mean, he's really, I mean, aside from how close all these elections have been, you know, the only time a presidential nominee in Wisconsin has gotten 50% of the vote even or higher since 1988 is Barack Obama. Nobody else has done it. So that tells you how evenly divided the state has been. It also tells you kind of how exceptional Barack Obama's performance was in those two elections. They're also really the only examples in modern times of Wisconsin kind of voting significantly to the left of the country as a whole. You know, in fact, now we're in a period when Wisconsin is voting pretty consistently a little bit to the right of the national popular vote, which the way the Electoral College works happens to put us, you know, kind of right there on the tipping point. But I do think Barack Obama doesn't sort of fit in to these other patterns. You know, I've had a lot of conversations over the years with mm-hmm. people in both parties about why they think that may be true. And the answers, you know, range from everything to just, you know, his particular political skill set to even, you know, the fact that he's from next door Illinois and, you know, a Midwestern candidate. You know, it's a little bit mysterious, but I do think that you're right. The Obama elections gave us a little bit of a false picture of Wisconsin. And, you know, when we think about all those communities and all those counties in Wisconsin that voted for Obama and then voted for Trump, you know, some of them are purple counties, but some of them are Republican counties where Barack Obama just overperformed as a Democrat.
And I think it gave people, you mentioned kind of maybe a false impression, especially after 2008, when you had Wisconsin going for a Democratic president, Democrats having control of all of state government. That really covered up the close nature of the state, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that was a wave election. So I think it was understood even at the time that it was a wave election. And I mean, if you looked at the map, I mean, basically the whole state practically was blue, including a lot of counties that, you know, don't normally vote Democratic. So I don't think Democrats were under any illusions. But again, it wasn't just that it was a wave election nationally. It was that Barack Obama, I mean, he won the state by 14 points. So he won it by a significantly larger margin than he won the national popular vote. And again, that happened on a lesser scale again in 2012. So it was even in relation to the rest of the country, you know, he had these big, big victories here. You know, you can look at the Obama side of the equation. You can also look at the Republican side of the equation. I mean, his opponents, you know, John McCain and Mitt Romney, it's just possible that they weren't particularly great fits for Wisconsin. I mean, we've talked a lot about how Wisconsin's demographics, you know, an unusually large blue-collar white vote, probably not a group that Mitt Romney naturally appeals to. And Donald Trump comes along and really sort of speaks to that group in a different way and does much better than Mitt Romney. So it's not just who the Democratic candidate is, it's also who the Republican candidate is.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about how Wisconsin votes in presidential elections, usually very close, with the exception of Barack Obama recently. And we'll look at how different parts of the state, different regions have changed over time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kevin is with us in Cornell, Michigan. Kevin, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Well, you know, listen, I am... I mean, typically I've been a Democratic voter for the last probably 20 years. But I have flip-flopped a couple times if I think the candidate is better. And I voted for Donald Trump last time in 16, with my only hope being that the Republicans would come together and see how ridiculous he is, because the rhetoric that he spouts all the time drives me insane. But I could not get behind Hillary Clinton. Somehow or another, we're all tired of the same thing. And we're looking for people to come together and get to the middle and get some stuff solved. Because, God, we need help here.
So don't keep us in suspense, Kevin. 2016, you went Trump. 2020, if you're willing to share.
Oh, this year? Absolutely Biden all day long.
Okay.
I can't stand to listen to Donald Trump talk ever again. If I never hear his voice again, I will be totally happy.
Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. Craig, it doesn't take many people like Kevin to have flipped an election to and then away from Donald Trump, right?
No, it doesn't. But I do think the overwhelming share of people that voted for Donald Trump last time voted for him again. I mean, I'm sure that's true. There aren't a lot of switchers. I mean, but, you know, if you look at the 2016 election, you had a 6% of the people that voted for a third party candidate. So part of the equation this time around was what did they do? And then we also had a much higher turnout, which meant that people that didn't vote at all in 2016 played a role in this election. So I think there were probably more people that switched from Trump in 2016 to Biden in 2020 than people that switched from Clinton in 2016 to Trump in 2020. But at the same time, and there were probably people that voted third party in 2016, I've talked to some of them that voted for both, either candidate in 2020, but then a big component this time around were the new voters. And we know that, some of them were Democrats, but a lot of them were Republicans. I mean, there was a big turnout spike in this election, and the counties, if you look at the map, that had the biggest increase in turnout proportionately were kind of smaller, mostly rural counties where Donald Trump won by sizable margins. That's where you saw a lot of the increase in turnout. And we didn't see any increase in turnout or very little increase in turnout in Milwaukee County and none in the city of Milwaukee.
Let's bring out another caller. Jeff with us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I just want to point out that in the pantheon of American presidents, John F. Kennedy visited Superior in 1960 and he won. George H.W. Bush visited Superior and he won in 1988, and Trump visited Superior in 2016. Those three men were all elected president, and I think Superior is a good luck charm.
Craig, there you have it. I mean, we could throw these numbers away. Visit Superior. It's the road to the White House. What do you think?
Yeah, I am all for that. Superior is a great place to go. I have a grandfather who grew up next door in Duluth, and I had a grandfather, and Superior is an interesting place politically. I mean, that whole region of Wisconsin where you've got that little Democratic belt of three counties in mostly kind of a sea of red that remains blue and remains Democratic. I know you wanted to talk about some of the changes in the map, and a lot of counties across central and northern Wisconsin have gotten redder in the Trump elections and even to some degree in the midterm elections, while other parts of Wisconsin have gotten bluer.
Yeah. So you mentioned these rural counties that Donald Trump performed well in 2016. He solidified or even improved in those places. Where did Democrats see their biggest gains?
Well, there's sort of two ways to look at this. If you look at it in terms of percentage points, the way the margin changed, the two biggest swings away from the Republicans were the same counties that had the biggest swings away from Republicans in 2016. And that was Ozaukee County and Waukesha County, two red counties in southeastern Wisconsin that are Republican, but have gotten less Republican in the Trump years. So they had the biggest swings away from Donald Trump this time, just like last time. But if you look at it in terms of raw votes, which is really what matters, when we're talking about winning a presidential election, where were the big net gains for the Democratic Party? The biggest was Dane County, where Democrats actually had a net gain of about 35,000 votes, which is by itself, easily more, enough to swing the election for Biden, since Trump only won by a little under 23,000 last time. And then you had in Milwaukee County, you had a swing of about 20,000 votes. And then after that in Waukesha, you had a swing of about 7,000 or 8,000 votes. We've talked about Waukesha. But in Dane and Milwaukee County, there were three places where we saw those shifts. There was the city of Madison. There was the rest of Dane County, which is basically the suburbs of Madison. and then in the suburbs of Milwaukee within Milwaukee County. So the rest of Milwaukee County, when you take the city of Milwaukee out of the picture, you saw, additional swings toward the Democratic Party across, you know, these Milwaukee County suburbs. So I think it's really fair to say that Donald Trump lost this election mostly in the blue suburbs of Madison and Milwaukee.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about trends in Wisconsin politics and why presidential elections here are so close. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think we're usually so close in these presidential races, with the exception of Barack Obama? What was it, do you think, about Barack Obama that let him win by more comfortable margins than all the nail biters we've had in other recent years? What have you seen changing in your part of the state, whatever part that might be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at why Wisconsin's presidential elections often come down to the wire, why they're close, and how things are changing in regions around the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Craig, let's look at the third big population center of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and the Fox Cities, that corridor up there. What did we see this time around?
So the three major counties of the Fox Valley, Brown County, Outagamie County, and Winnebago County, all voted for Donald Trump, but by smaller margins than they did in 2016. So together, those three counties, you had about an 8,000 vote shift toward the Democrats, net shift simply by virtue of the fact that Donald Trump's winning margin in those places was smaller than it was in 2016. So that was a contributor, but not nearly enough by itself to swing the election to Joe Biden.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jim is with us in Janesville. Jim, hi.
See, I'm always curious as to why in Wisconsin, as well as any states with large metro areas, why do the large cities tend to always seem to be very Democratic? I find that kind of fascinating. Is it What is it about having a group of people in a condensed metropolitan area that makes them almost without question US-wide be Democratic? I find that fascinating.
Interesting, Jim. A good fundamental question there, Craig. What do we know? Craig, what do we know?
Well, I mean, you know, there's two ways to look at that. You can say, what is it about being in a city that makes you Democratic? But you can also look at it as, you know, who wants to live in cities, or who lives in cities, or who's attracted to cities? I think, you know, both you can look at it both ways, and they both provide insight. I mean, this is a very strong pattern, obviously, not only a strong pattern in our politics, but an increasingly strong pattern. I mean, we all know that urban areas have become increasingly blue. They've been blue for a long time. And just as rural areas have become increasingly red, it's demographics. It's cities have a different, you know, they're more diverse. They have a different population mix. And there's a lot of, you know, evidence, again, that people self-select to some degree in the kinds of places they want to live. And, cities appear to attract people that are Democratic voters. Even with all the changes we've seen in a city like Milwaukee, one of the things that happened in Milwaukee, if you go back several decades, was what was known at the time as white flight, where you had voters leaving the city and moving to the suburbs, and in some cases making the suburbs more conservative and making the cities more liberal when they left. Cities are always going through these demographic changes. And actually, you know, in this election, the city of Milwaukee didn't really contribute very much at all to the shift from a narrow Trump victory to a narrow Biden victory. In fact, Joe Biden basically won the city of Milwaukee by almost the exact same margin that Hillary Clinton won it by. Turnout didn't increase. So it's kind of ironic that even though some of the baseless claims that have been made about irregularities in this vote have pointed toward the city of Milwaukee or the city of Philadelphia or the city of Detroit in Michigan and Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, when in fact we know from looking at the vote returns that it wasn't the cities, those cities where Joe Biden flipped those states, because those cities basically performed the same way they did in this election as they did 4 years ago. It was the suburbs where the vote changed and in a material way contributed to the shifts from red to blue in those states.
Time for one more caller. Bethany is with us in West Bend. Bethany, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up?
Through in a while. I just wanted to bring up that I really feel that the reason that some of the change has occurred in the voting is due to the fact that people are educated. And I think it's been an insult to the intelligence of our communities and our state and in our local even area that people wouldn't think deeper than what has been presented over the last 4 years. I mean, even from the perspective of being able to present and stand in front of people and give well thought out policy and procedure and factual information. It's just really, honestly, I have felt insulted every day when I have listened to this person represent our country and who we are. And I am so glad to see that people saw that and experienced it and have realized that this is not good for any of us. So.
Bethany, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, there's a lot of question about how much the personality, the presentation of Donald Trump might have steered away voters. Craig, is there any way we're ever going to be able to measure that?
Well, not with any great precision. I mean, you know, sort of anecdotally talking to voters, you know, we've all talked to voters, you know, Republican-leaning and conservative-leaning voters who felt conflicted over Donald Trump because they had problems with his tweets or they had problems with his personality. They had problems with his behavior, but they liked, you know, A, they may have liked his policies. They may have liked all of his policies. And B, you know, if you're a conservative or a Republican, you really don't want to vote for a Democratic candidate. And so in many cases, that drove those voters back to Donald Trump, even if they had qualms. A smaller number of people that, you know, that liked his policies, but could not get past those personal qualms and didn't vote for him. And didn't vote for him either in 2016 or in 2020. But the exact mix, I mean, most people kind of vote with their, you know, with their side, with their party, right or left. And they kind of live with their qualms if they have qualms.
Briefly, Craig, what questions are unanswered from you so far coming out of 2020?
Well, I think we did see a big increase in turnout. The turnout was bigger again in sort of smaller Republican counties. You know, there's some evidence in the exit polls that this electorate was actually several points more Republican than Democratic, which I'm not sure I believe because it's hard to imagine Donald Trump losing an election in Wisconsin where the electorate was more Republican than Democratic. But I have more questions about the turnout, just about the mix. In terms of the vote. And of course, you know, how enduring are some of these patterns and trends that we've been seeing? We've seen them now for several cycles. Are they going to endure past the Donald Trump years in terms of this kind of, you know, the rural areas marching onward toward the Republican side and the suburban areas continuing to erode for Republicans? And Donald Trump even made some small inroads in the cities among Latino voters, particularly. Are these trends enduring? So those are the big questions in my mind. We've seen some pretty powerful trends that have kind of offset each other in Wisconsin. But, you know, how durable are those trends?
And Craig, a fun fact, you may already know the biggest vote share for any presidential candidate in Wisconsin history, if I'm reading this right, 1920 Warren G. Harding, 71.1% of the vote. Craig, can any candidate recapture that Warren Harding magic in this era?
Like I said, I think six out of the last eight, or maybe it's either six out of the last eight or eight out of the last 10 presidential nominees in Wisconsin haven't even reached 50%, including the winners, with Barack Obama being the only exception. So that kind of tells you a lot about where we're at as a state, how evenly divided the state is. So I don't think we're going to get back up into the 70-point territory, much less even the higher mid-50s.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be with you.
That's Craig Gilbert with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the close finish in last week's presidential election and the bigger picture of changes in Wisconsin. Coming up next, it's news, and then Have You Forgotten What Fun Feels Like? Our guest explores what exactly it takes to have fun and why it may be hard to find lately. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.